loftiest of names, you know, another type of name that has been recommended in the riwayat are the names depicting, you know, being a slave of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, such as Abdullah or Abdul Rahman, yes. These kind of names. So yes, you know, names that are, you know, lowly, that are not, you know, decent names, we're not supposed to have those for children. One thing that I think kind of unfortunately has taken, you know, root in our societies is a lack of attention towards these names, right? Because of the way that, you know, what the modern world is, which is a rejection of everything that is old, that's traditional.
Yes.
And when once a society gets into that mentality, what they want to do is, and the word modern itself means this as well, they want to have everything be new, right? So then instead of naming, you know, thinking of, okay, what's the best name that I can pick for a child? They think of what is the newest name I can pick for a child?
Yes.
What is the, you know, nicest sounding name, the coolest name that is in fashion these days that I can pick for a child? Unfortunately, people have, you know, they go after this and they pick names that are, you know, strange names that just sound nice to that society at that time. But they don't have a profound meaning. They don't have anything profound behind them.
Yes, right? That's right.
And if you say that, okay, you know, no, you should name them after the imams and the prophets.
Yes.
And they'll say that, oh, you know, but our grandfather, they were named. This, you know, Ali was my grandfather. I can't name my child that. No, you know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, all of his sons were named Ali.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
He, you know, and I believe there's a hadith from as well that where he, you know, one of the rulers says that, you know, you're Ali to I believe Imam Zain al-Abdin.
Yes.
Your brother is Ali.
Yes.
Now, what is this? And the Imam Hussein, when he hears of this, he says that if I had, you know, many, many sons, I would name them all Ali.
Yes.
Right. So, no, repetition in name is not a bad thing. Obviously, you know, we should name them something that we can, you know, distinguish from other people. But the names of al-Bayt, they're very special names.
That's right. Imam al-Razali salam says that al-Baytu al-Lazi fihi Muhammadun yusbu ahluhu bikhayrin wa yumsuna bikhayrin. You know, when
the house in which there is a Muhammad.
Yeah, there's a Muhammad, you know, and the sunset and the sunrise will be with khayr,
right,
you know.
So the whole day is basically
the whole day,
with goodness, with
khayr. Or for example, the poverty will not reach a house in which these names
are there,
are selected for the people of the house. And, you know, especially when you name a child after the infallible imams or prophets or something like that, you know, when you call such a person, it is a reminder for the person himself too that, listen, be careful. Mm-hmm. You are titled by such a holy name, so you have to take more about your deeds and actions.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Like somebody who knows who has a name like, you know, Muhammad or in the names of the Imam or Lady Fatima alayhi salam, if they have attention towards what this name is, what it depicts, who were the personalities, you know, described by this name.
Yes.
Then naturally it's a push to become more and more like them, become closer to them, be like Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, be like Fatima alayhi salam, definitely. But on the other hand as well, which is a bit scary, and hopefully it doesn't scare people away from naming their kids these names, is that for the parent as well, who names their child Muhammad or Fatima, now they have to be careful as well. There are hadiths that point towards this that say that, you know, if you name your child Muhammad or Fatima, you know, don't frown at them, don't hit them, don't scold them, right? So now, because the child has a name that is a lofty name,
dignified
name, you know, the parents.
Or for example, do not call their names by bad titles or bad descriptive phrases.
Right, right.
Okay, that's right.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praises to Allah, all glory to Allah, we worship Allah and no one but Allah.
So That's right. We have to take lots of care about selecting a name, especially for the girls, you know, and the women of the society. Selecting a good name, which are the titles or nicknames or eponyms of Lady Fatima to Zahra, is very much recommended for them. And this has shown that, for example, how much respected the ladies were in the eyes of Prophet Muhammad and the fallible imams, something contrary to the Arabs of the Jahiliyyah, who used to bury their girl, new girl, alive, unfortunately, because they consider this is a disgrace for them to have a child girl. That's right.
The Prophet, he would, if Lady Fatima should walk in, he would get up from his place, sit her on you know, where he was sitting, and basically do a lot, you know, dignify her. So, which was quite contrary to the culture at that time.
That's right. Unfortunately, sometimes nowadays, in the modern world, we can see that the people, as you said, say, okay, these names are archaic, they are obsolete, out of date, or something like that. Let's, for example, select a name which seems new, new to the eyes, or for example, new to the ears of the people. And maybe selecting a name for some people is a matter of reputation or attraction, you know, in order to absorb the attraction, the ears of the people. Right. But the meaning of and the content of the name and title should be very much important, isn't it?
No, it should be very important. Unfortunately, that is the case that people, you know, pick random sounding names, and sometimes they're not even like
they don't know the meaning. Sometimes
they don't have meaning. Sometimes they have strange meanings. Like for example, although this is another way people pick names, which I don't think is the correct way. Or at least they should ask somebody who is a scholar about these names. They open the Quran, and the word that they find, they just name that. So I've you know, known people with, you know, strange sounding names that in Arabic, like, you know, they don't make much sense. So if somebody wants to do that, then they should, you know, at least ask a scholar that, okay, what does this mean? Can I name a child, you know, this word or not? Right. So you know, basically the meaning should be a good meaning.
And the children with good naming, I mean, familiar sounding words in terms of linguistics, you know, are welcomed in the public more rather than strange names. Because if a child is named strangely on that time, the children remind themselves, what kind of name is this? Okay.
Right.
What kind of character is this? Let's welcome it or let's not welcome that boy or girl.
Yeah, so if somebody names their child based on, you know, the names that are popular at one time, okay. Well, in maybe a few decades, that name might not be popular anymore. And people just look at it and be like, you know, what kind of name is this, right? So it's not a good idea to go after what are the trends, what is popular.
Yes.
You know, it's a good idea to go after what the Ahlul Bayt and, you know, they have told us.
And as we said, selecting a name has direct role in shaping the future of such a person. And for example, if a person is called Kadhim, you know, it is a reminder for him that, for example, take care to control your anger. Every day. Okay? So, but, you know, or when some, calling such names must be complete, is better to say. For example, we cannot pronounce Muhammad as Mammat, or we can say Hussein or Hussein as, for example, Hussein or something like that in a shortened form. Okay,
it's better not to.
It's better not to. For example, it is Mahdi. It is not Mehdi or Mehdi or something like that. Okay, so it's better to when such holy names are selected for our children, it's better to pronounce them as correctly, as the Anbiya and the Awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala used to pronounce them. Because even pronouncing such a name is holy.
Right. Okay. One other thing that I would say is another trend that we see, especially in the West.
Yes.
Because over there, people have moved there from, you know, these other Muslim countries. And they want to blend in.
Yes.
They don't want to stand out.
Yes.
So then they give their kids names that are, you know, somewhat Islamic sounding, yes, but they're okay with, you know, names over there as well. Or sometimes, you know, they would give them completely non-Islamic names.
Yes.
Or sometimes they give them Islamic names, but yes, then call them, you know, like, for example, Muhammad turns into Mo.
Oh, no, it's not good. Mo is not good. Brother Mo.
Brother Mo. It's not good. And many certain instances.
Yes.
I think we Muslims have to be very careful.
Yes.
Very, very careful. That it's not just a name. It's not, yes, just like, you know, something, you know, arbitrary.
Yes.
Right.
It is not a brand. It's not a title of a goods to be sold out, right, in the markets.
As you said, it has an, yes, effect on the person. Yes. And one thing is that it helps them formulate their identity as well.
Uh-huh.
Right. Muhammad, even when Muhammad becomes bigger,
yes,
you know, he knows that he is still Muhammad.
Yes.
Right. There is this connection to, you know, the Islamic, you know, ummah, connection, yes, to the Islamic lands, yes, to the Islamic people, to Islam itself. Whereas somebody who has a completely, you know, Western sounding name, okay, then that's, they're one step, you know, removed from that, right? Their name is Western. Then slowly, slowly, you know, obviously living there is like that, that, you know, people's culture, if they're not careful, it changes as well. And their identity becomes that of a, you know, a person who's a Westerner.
That's right. Okay.
And it's not limited to just Western lands either, mm-hmm, right? To the extent that Western, you know, ideals and Western culture has infiltrated Islamic lands as well. We see such, you know, cases in Islamic lands too.
That's
that,
right,
people slowly, slowly, they go away from, you know, what is supposed to be an Islamic culture, Islamic way of being and living, and they adopt the Western way of being, living, dressing, right? And a name is something that, you know, shows that as well, that change, which is an unfortunate change.
That's right. A very much good example in the recent years, and this is my last wordings, was Muhammad Ali's Hollywood star, which is on the wall.
Right.
You know that the Hollywood stars, we can say, has this walk of fame or something,
right,
wall of fame or, mm-hmm, something like that. Muhammad Ali said that, I want my star on the wall and not on the ground. And when he was asked why, he said, I don't want the people to step on the name of Muhammad and Ali.
Right.
And this was, we can't say, see, if you Google Muhammad Ali, for example, a star on the wall, why is it not on the ground? You can find the respect, so much respect that he had even for, mm-hmm, the name. Mm-hmm. When he converted to Islam, he selected the name Muhammad Ali for himself. Mm-hmm. That's right. Thank you very much, mm-hmm, Sayyid Zain, for a nice elaboration regarding selecting a good name for our children. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
يوسف جلالي تهران.
روباشافيت غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
رشا سغلام اسطنبول.
سعيد امين عالمي كابول.
شهانة بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Italian cities were the scene of rallies in solidarity with Gaza and in condemnation of Israel's inhuman attacks against Palestinian civilians. Rome, Florence, Pisa, Syracuse, Grosseto, for the umpteenth time since early October, tens of thousands of people across Italy took to the streets of their respective cities to express their anger at the Italian government for unconditionally supporting the Israeli regime and at the international community for its complicity in Gaza genocide.
Ad oggi, ma anche in passato.
Today, more than ever, international law is just an abstract set of norms which prevails over humanity. Millions of people have died since the Sykes-Picot Accord over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing over the fact that Palestine is a state or not.
Passeremo alla storia.
We'll go down in history as those who silently supported the genocide period.
Italy has not condemned Israel for the killing of unarmed Palestinians collecting aid in Gaza in an attack that killed more than 100 people on Thursday. However, Rome has called on the Israeli regime to investigate the incident and bring the perpetrators behind the Eid massacre to justice.
The Italian police crackdown on students during Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the past weeks has sparked outrage across Italy. Student collectives are at loggerheads with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and police over the rise in attacks against students.
The government and police repression has revealed the bare truth. Our country is a democracy only on paper. Ours are simply the democracies of double standards and deception. We have been attacked during our protest for peace in Ukraine, and we are attacked today. We perfectly know how democracies work in Western countries.
Thousands of artists, curators and critics have signed an open letter calling on the Venice Biennale, one of the world's largest contemporary visual art exhibitions, to exclude the Israeli National Pavilion from this year's art exhibition due to the brutal assaults against the civilians in Gaza. However, Italy's culture minister has firmly backed Israel's participation. Max Civili, Rome.
Across France, supporters of Palestine marched to denounce Israel's constant atrocities and war crimes during their latest invasion of Gaza. The world has been stunned by what's been dubbed the Flower Massacre, the death of over 100 Palestinians and the wounding of nearly 800 others after Israeli troops opened fire on civilians waiting for food.
We are here to ask for sanctions and to expose the hypocrisy of those who say they were shocked by the killing of people starving that were getting humanitarian aid, but at the same time don't do anything to stop the genocide.
Some 600,000 people in Gaza, or 25% of the population, are currently at risk of famine.
The French Foreign Ministry said the shootings were unjustifiable and backed a call for an independent investigation by the United Nations. French President Emmanuel Macron demanded truth, justice, respect for international law, and called for an immediate ceasefire.
In the Western world, which is and remains accomplice with the Israeli genocide, but a slight change in the tone of all those Western leaders, including Emmanuel Macron. Remember that a few months ago, Macron was proposing a military coalition to fight the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
4 years ago, Macron forced through a bill which equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, despite the obvious differences between the two.
Il a deux visages.
Macron is two-faced. It is only since the International Criminal Court announced that they would investigate Israel that Macron began to say just a few words which were not in total support of Israel. He continues to give arms to Israel and is as complicit as the leaders in Tel Aviv.
Many marchers carried signs of deceased United States soldier Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire at the Israeli embassy in Washington after declaring that he will no longer be complicit in genocide. After the start of Israel's invasion of Gaza, France imposed a nationwide ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations around the country. Activists were forced to endure mass arrests, a record number of fines, and the infamous brutality of France's police. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years. Until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly elected.
A sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway from Rochdale.
Apart from bread-and-butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty, and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This as a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there and asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue, and it's an international issue. But at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue. It's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign center lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
By-elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saipur Rizza, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
On Thursday, a demonstration was staged in Rome's Parliament Square in protest against the arrest of Anan Yaish, a 37-year-old Palestinian citizen from Tul Kaum in the West Bank. Anan was arrested without charge or justifiable cause by the Italian police in the central Italy mountain city of L'Aquila on January 29 on an extradition request by the Israeli government, which Italy's justice ministry acquiesced straight away. A month later, Anan, who holds a valid residence permit in Italy since 2017, is still detained in a prison wing housing only terrorists in the city of Terni.
Anan's detention is similar to Israel's administrative detention, when a person is kept in prison without trial, without having committed an offence. Israel even wants to intimidate the Palestinians who live abroad.
Israel believes Anan has committed one and only very serious offence. He has not given up the fight. That's why they are behind him. Italy is surveillance subservient as usual with Israel. Our authorities have arrested an innocent man who is just a member of the Palestinian resistance.
During the demonstration, activists strongly condemned Italy's government for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We know full well how heavy Israel's influence is on the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni wanted to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations. We have seen her going hand-in-hand with Netanyahu.
More pro-Palestine protests will be held in Italy at the weekend. Large demonstrations will take place in Rome, Florence and Pisa. Meanwhile, a group of Italian lawmakers announced they will travel to the Rafah border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. They say they want to provide the Italian government with a testimony of the tragedy the Palestinians are experiencing as a result of Israel's crimes. Max Civili, Rome.
The new satellite Pars 1 aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars-1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We're very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars-1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites. The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzana Shuryan, Tehran.
Pakistan's newly elected lower house of the parliament met for the first time on Thursday, with freshly elected members taking oaths amid protests on the floor by the supporters of jailed former premier Imran Khan. They called for an audit of the recently held polls in the country.
We will bring back our beloved leader Imran Khan along with the mainstream leadership of our party with the power vested in the newly formed parliament. We demanded on the floor of the House that the chief election commissioner and officials of the electoral body should step down immediately because they were involved in poll rigging and manipulation of results.
Although candidates supported by the imprisoned Khan secured the majority of seats in the country's National Assembly, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party, along with their political allies, have united in an alliance to establish a coalition government. They have nominated former Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif as their candidate for the country's chief executive position for a second term. Khan's opponents say that the democracy has emerged victorious, while those setting up obstacles in the way of country's progress and prosperity have been defeated.
We consider Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf as a roadblock to the country's progress and prosperity. They are attempting to sabotage democracy through the rhetoric of poll rigging and are striving to foment anarchy in the country.
Efforts from the government coalition to persuade its former key ally have encountered a hurdle, with the leader of Pakistan's primary religious political faction affirming its decision to refrain from participating in the formation of the government. Once the head of the former coalition, the chief of Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, parted ways with the newly formed coalition and decided not to be involved in forming the new government.
A hung parliament in Pakistan has been sworn in amid allegations of poll rigging and results manipulation. Experts say that the formation of a coalition government in the country with a split mandate would face severe political challenges in the days to come. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
As a result of a broad consensus in Iraq to end the presence of U.S.-led international coalition forces from the country, both the Iraqi nation and government made it crystal clear that these military forces are no longer needed. Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-A'raji stated that all political factions in the country have agreed on the need to end the presence of U.S.-led military coalition purportedly formed to fight Daesh terrorist group.
Today, we're witnessing the negotiation with the international coalition forces, and honestly, what makes us the Iraqi people exasperated is the insistence by the U.S. to keep its troops on our land to have an intervention in the military scene of Iraq and neighboring Syria.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani stated that the Western Alliance mission will end at the Baghdad government's official request. He also said that the government is setting a date for the start of bilateral committee talks, which includes representatives of the military coalition to put arrangements to end the presence of international coalition forces in Iraq permanently.
We have collected more than 100 signatures and prepared the legal draft to end the international coalition mission in Iraq. And we pledge before God to our people that we will enact the law to expel the foreign forces from our land.
The demands to end U.S. military presence in Iraq are not new. After Washington's assassination of top Iraqi and Iranian anti-terror commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes 4 years ago, Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces who can endanger security and stability in Iraq and jeopardize civil peace. Following the recent attacks on anti-terror forces and the continued violations on the country's sovereignty, the Iraqi nation and government are now determined to end the presence of foreign military forces to prevent any further escalations that can endanger the stability and security of Iraq. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations human rights chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Turk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a grand assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations highest court On 26th of January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out, "The responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid." Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response, and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and open the access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings, to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort, given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza. The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace." Ilhan Omar stressed, "If we truly want to uplift humanity to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now." Ilhan Omar also expressed disappointment with the response from the United States and the world's political leaders to Israeli atrocities in Gaza, underlining that empty rhetoric about human rights without any meaningful action is unacceptable. The Democratic congresswoman from Minnesota said the Biden administration's policies lack effective pressure on Israel and fail to deter the Israeli regime from continuing with its crimes against Palestinians. Ilhan Omar added, "Despite the clarity surrounding Gaza's despair, the response from political leaders has been nothing short of callous. Empty rhetoric about human rights ring hollow when no action follows." She added, "This administration's policies fail to meaningfully pressure the Israeli regime through restrictions, sanctions, or any hint of consequences. Each war crime and violation compiled by journalists, human rights groups, and United Nations agencies are bearing witness."
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
I am Bita, and with me
is Mustafa.
Okay, so once again, we have the opportunity to be here talking about some controversial issues and topics. I'm studying medicine, and at medical university, everybody is like, for example, "Oh, are you studying medicine? Then you must be this. You must be so smart, intelligent. You must, for example, sacrifice a lot of time to studying."
Are you
but
not doing that? Are
no,
you not
like I'm the one that are doing this. But there are so many people at my university that they don't care about studying, and it's okay in their major and in the science or knowledge of medicine, and you know. It's one of the habits of people to generalize things into other groups of people. For example, because they don't have enough knowledge of the uniqueness of individuals, they will feel like, for example, if you are from this group of people, then you have this characteristic. So have you ever experienced this kind of situation that, for example, because of your nation or because of your country, they kind of connect you to a specific attribute or not?
Of course, definitely. And I've lived in different countries, you know, so I've lived among different cultures.
Yeah.
And, you know, stereotyping cultures or people is very common, by the way, very, very common. And, you know, there's actually positives to it and negatives as well.
Right? Yeah.
The sort of the positive things that come out of stereotypes is that, you know, as human beings, we're pattern-seeking creatures. Have you ever heard that?
No.
So one of the, you know, in science that they talk about, a human being, you know, everything that we do is actually through pattern recognition.
Yeah.
Right? For example, when reading is a way of pattern recognition, right? Every symbol means something. So when we generalize things, what we're really looking at is like we're looking at a pattern among a certain group of people, and that becomes a stereotype. And that can be helpful in situations. I'm trying to think of like when that can be helpful. Can you think of a situation where that can be? I know there are places where it can be helpful.
You know, I believe actually there is a proverb in my culture that we say there should be something if you hear something about a group of people. So, for example, if we say this group of people are like that, there must be a kind of background to this group that this attribute or this characteristic is connected to this group. For example, when you go through a new country, and most of the people, for example, say, "Oh, this country." The people of this country are not very good to strangers or to the people of other countries. And when you go through the atmosphere of that country, you see, yeah, it's like that. I mean, it's not completely a big lie to generalize a thing. When you generalize, it means that you watch that behavior repeatedly. So there is something. Right. I mean, there is a basis of truth behind the stereotypes. It's not like, for example, all stereotypes are lie.
Right. But you know where it does become harmful is when you start attributing those negative stereotypes to individuals, right? Let's say now you learned that I'm from Pakistan. Whatever negative stereotypes exist in your head about Pakistan, you start applying them to me.
Exactly.
Which may not necessarily be true about me specifically, right? Those things may exist maybe in my culture among certain people, but every individual is different, right? Not every individual follows like every aspect of their culture.
For sure. And, you know, it happens a lot because our brain tends to connect different information together.
That's the pattern recognition right there. Yeah,
this is a pattern. For example, if you have a car accident and at that day you, for example, saw a black cat, your brain kind of connects these two information together. And after that, you always attribute this characteristic of bad luck to a black cat. The exact thing that happens in this stereotype, even for example, you connect this characteristic to a specific nation, as you mentioned. So let's talk more about the negative parts of a stereotype after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Youth Station, and we were talking about the good and bad dimensions of stereotype.
Right. And, you know, one of the negatives, unfortunately, I think we all realize, is that it makes us racist or prejudiced against certain people. That's, I think, one of the biggest things that we see, that people become racist against others. And in turn, they start thinking they're better than others, right? That's definitely one of the biggest negatives that I can think of, is that you
become
racist.
Yeah, for sure. Discrimination, racism, and these kind of consequences of a stereotype are the things that we can see in the world around us. And this is not something far away, because most of the people think, like, for example, oh, racism. We are at 21st century, and at this age, we don't have any racism. Yeah. But it's not like that. When you go and travel through different countries and different cultures, you will understand that there is something like that. And another point is that most of the time, a lack of understanding of the uniqueness of individuals and the depth of everybody's soul will lead you to stereotype and generalizing a kind of belief to a combination.
For example, I've definitely created stereotypes in my mind, you know, for certain groups of people.
Yeah.
And it's because I see them as being true many times. For example, I might say, you know, Indians are like hardworking people. You know, I might say like one stereotype. So I used to work in a university.
Yeah.
And, you know, computer science, I used to interact with a lot of computer science students, many different students. One of the stereotypes that's in my mind is a lot of people that have studied computer science, their social skills aren't that great.
Yeah, okay? Like the example I gave you at the beginning of our episode.
Of course, but there's always exceptions to these, right?
Yeah.
To these sort of stereotypes.
But, you know, most of the people say, like, exceptions don't break the rule.
Yeah, I'm saying my point was that because of the exceptions, you have to be open-minded.
Yeah.
You don't have to be, you don't be judgmental from the first, you know, from the very beginning. you can have that stereotype in the back of your mind about those people. Then once you interact with them, they may be proven or disproven.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to be open-minded to sort of anything could happen, because a human being is a very complex creature. You know, you can't really put us all in like one box or one label. So that my solution to that is keeping my mind open, right? Yeah. Not being judgmental about people, despite having those stereotypes. A lot of times when I tell people that I'm studying psychology, they're like, well, tell me about me, you know? Tell me about myself.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I'm like, well, I can't just like look at you and tell you about yourself. You know, they think I can like read their mind or something. That's not what psychology is, right?
Yeah.
Psychology is a big part is getting the person to talk to you and tell you about themselves.
Exactly.
That's one of the main sort of ways to do that. One technique that I think really helps, a psychological technique that I sometimes use in my interactions, is sympathy and empathy.
Yeah.
Okay. What do I mean by that? When I speak to people, I try to understand like what's their pain point, right? What's causing them those difficulties or pains in their life? And you try to empathize with that. You put yourself in their place, no matter what it is. Even if it's something that I would never do, but I see that other person doing, I try to understand why they're doing it. What's the cause behind it? And that's made me so much like relaxed with people. It's made me so much, people do start telling me their secrets because of just this technique. Right?
Yeah.
People start telling me things about their lives, which would probably never happen before. So one way to dealing with stereotypes is that, you know, or people, is you sympathize and empathize with them and try to understand what's the reason behind that behavior, rather than like trying to judge them for that behavior.
Yeah, I got it. One of the problems that this stereotype actually poses in my way as a medical student is that most of the people have this picture of an old man with white hair and white, mustache as a doctor. And for example, when they see a woman, which is, for example, mostly young, as a doctor, they cannot believe or they cannot put their trust into that person. This is one of the stereotypes that, I have a lot of problem with. And, it feels like, oh my God, I have to be too old to get the trust of people in my major or in my job.
I'll have to look at your handwriting to figure out if you're really a doctor or not, because doctors have the worst handwritings. I'm not even joking. Like, this is a stereotype that I believe in, okay? I don't know why this has happened 3 or 4 times. I got a prescription.
Yeah.
I had to post it on a group to ask people, like, hey, what's written here?
But there is a reason, I believe, before any stereotype. For example, the reason of this bad handwriting of doctors is that they don't have enough time because there are so many patients there. And, for example, when you're a first-year medical student, then you have a beautiful handwriting, delicately, you're trying to put the details. But when you go higher and higher, you will understand that there is no need for you to actually waste your time on these beauties and delicate points of your job. And that's enough only to, for example, write the first letter of the drug or something like that, and the nurse will understand it. Let's go for
sure. Sure. So we're back from the break, and I was saying that, you know, the way we use stereotypes can be beneficial, actually. And the one place that came to my mind is, for example, it's used a lot in statistics and research. Right? One of the ways that, for example, research is done is you take a sample of a group, right, about any topic. And based off of that sample, you create generalizations, right? So it's very helpful in places like research and trying to, like, better understand whatever that question is.
Yeah.
Right? That's where it can be helpful.
I believe for every single thing in this world, there is a good dimension and there is a bad dimension. And it's the same for a stereotype or generalization whenever we talk about the people. And as you mentioned, we shouldn't put the whole trust in this generalization and have this background about people of a specific group that every individual of that group have the quality that we are talking about. It's not like that. The thing is, as we mentioned, there are both benefits beneficial parts and actually detrimental parts of this stereotype. But at the end of the day, we have to keep that in mind. Every individual is unique because Allah Almighty wants us to be unique and actually created us in a manner that we have a specific characteristics, a specific personality, and even one of the signs of our uniqueness is the imprint of our fingers. Okay, every human being and every individual has different imprints, and I believe this is a blessing for us to be unique, but still it doesn't mean that we don't have anything in common with each other. So if there is a good stereotype for your country, for your nation, good for you. Just let's prove it to other people that you have this characteristic. And if something bad, then you have to communicate with other people and talk to them in order to correct this mindset about your nation.
You know, one of the things that I do, what happens is when I do hear negative stereotypes, like, for example, about my own country or culture, I try to break those stereotypes.
Exactly.
So it can kind of work in reverse as well, that rather than you stereotyping others, you try to like change yourself so that you don't look like them anymore, right? That's something that a lot of people do. You know, they see that they're being viewed in a certain way, and then they will be motivated to change that sort of. I really believe in breaking stereotypes as well, especially negative stereotypes. I think that should be something that we should all be doing, right? Because there's definitely negative things that have come up in our tradition and cultures. From an Islamic point of view, I would say, you know, the Quran has continuously said, you know, has criticized those people who followed their ancestors' religion.
Yeah,
right. That in a way, because they're saying, look, you, even us, right? Even my ancestors, who are all Sayyid and, you know, we're Shia, I would still say that, you know, if I were to accept everything that my ancestors gave me,
that would be prejudice.
That would be bad, right? God says you should be thinking for yourself. You should be pondering for yourself and reaching the truth yourself.
Exactly.
Right? So that's how I can sort of relate it to this topic, is that our ancestor stereotypes, we need to break them. We need to bring about a revolution in the way the traditions, the bad traditions and things that we have in our culture.
And I believe that was the gist of what we talked up to here. Thank you for sharing it with us, brother. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. That was all the time we had for today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum. Alhamdulillah,
Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.